Most of us in healthcare are warm, caring people who are committed to keeping our patients safe and doing no harm. But there are some among us who do the unthinkable and betray our noble profession. On this podcast, we like to shine a light on the good and the bad. Each week, I'll be joined by another healthcare professional, and together we'll dive into these stories while chatting about nursing and healthcare along the way. I'm Tina, a registered nurse, and this is Good Nurse, Bad Nurse. Everybody, this is Tina again with Good Nurse, Bad Nurse. Welcome back to another episode. My guest host for this week, you may remember just a few episodes ago, nurse and author Brittany Daniels. Brittany, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Absolutely. It's great to have you back. Hopefully, we'll kind of make this a habit and you'll just get to come back on the regular.
Absolutely.
I love chatting with you. So I'm excited about this new friendship that we've formed here. So today, we're going to be shining some light on several cases that have happened somewhat recently involving emergency medical professionals, EMTs, paramedics specifically. These cases are shocking and very disturbing, but our goal is not to try to demonize a particular profession. Of course, you know, we pick on everybody on this podcast. I mean, you know, every profession is made up of people, and people are imperfect, and that's just the way it is. We come in all different shapes and sizes and personalities and attitudes, and we, you know, some people, unfortunately, I say that at the beginning of in the little intro, not everybody has the best intentions. So sometimes people do bad things and they don't mean to. They really are kind of clueless about it, and they just need some education, need to be made aware of what's going on. And some people just really don't care. And you just got to wonder, why do you go into this profession? And unfortunately, sometimes it's actually that they go into the profession for that reason. I think that's pretty rare, though.
It is rare. Thank God.
Yeah. I think that really, if you're that, you know, mean and malicious, where you're wanting to hurt someone, surely you can find a profession that's a lot easier to do than healthcare, because I don't know any healthcare job, like specific profession, that's actually easy. They're all really difficult. Hard to get into, difficult to carry out. A lot of times don't come along with a lot of respect, not a lot of pay. I mean, really, yeah. So I think the vast majority of people who go into healthcare have good intentions. So we're not doing this to try to pick on anyone. That's not why we do it. But we have to shine a light and expose, you know, these behaviors, habits, practices, you know, whatever you want to call them, that are not acceptable and that do harm to individuals, to families, communities, and our healthcare profession. It affects everyone, these things.
Did you know that you don't have to go all across the country to be a travel nurse? You certainly can, but you don't have to. I literally took an assignment that's an hour and a half away from my house, and I love it. I can stay in a hotel room if I want, or I can drive back home. So it's the best of both worlds for me. For my next assignment, we're going to get a cabin in the mountains that's about 2 hours from our house. So it'll really be like a little getaway. Also, one of my really good friends is going with me so we can share expenses. You guys, even if you're just a little curious about travel nursing, go to trustedhealth.com/goodnurse and fill out a profile so you can see what kind of jobs are out there and what they pay. Go to trustedhealth.com/goodnurse and fill out a profile.
Are you looking to take your career to the next level? Consider enrolling in the Doctor of Nursing Practice program at UC Irvine. The program offers a post-master's track for MSN prepared nurses and a family nurse practitioner track for those with at least a BSN. Their program, of course, is fully accredited, and their graduates are highly sought after by healthcare organizations across the country. If you're ready to take the next step in your nursing career, I encourage you to explore UCI Irvine's DNP program today. Visit nursing.uci.edu to learn more, and of course, we'll put a link on our website and you can access it at goodnursebadnurse.com. On August 24th, 2019, 23-year-old Colorado resident Elijah McLean was walking home after purchasing some iced tea from the local grocery store. McLean was wearing a ski mask and This was due to the fact that he had anemia and he would be cold a lot. So I can relate to this, honestly. I get cold and I'm always wanting to bundle up. So
yeah,
if it's, you know, it's outside and you have a condition, I don't care if it's August. It doesn't matter. For one thing, it's in Colorado. It's nighttime. If you say you're cold, you're cold. If you want to wear a ski mask, you wear a ski mask.
Exactly.
That's how I feel about it. So 911 dispatchers received a call reporting that a, quote, sketchy man wearing a ski mask was walking the streets and waving his arms. So the Aurora Police Department responded to the call and confronted McLean, who was confused as to why he was being stopped, as he was not engaging in any criminal activity. Sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? So police reported that McLean allegedly reached for their firearms while they were trying to handcuff him. So this is their story, that they were trying to handcuff him and he reached for their guns, one of their guns. They used a carotid hold to subdue him and bring him to the ground. I think everybody's probably pretty familiar with what they're talking about. This it's called different things, but basically it's putting pressure on the carotid artery. And that lack of flow will bring you down very quickly. Basically, you just pass out. You're not getting oxygen to your brain. Let's get to the ground so we can hopefully get increased blood flow to the brain. That's what happens.
Exactly.
Well, he complained to the officers that he could not breathe. Again, this is a very familiar aspect to these stories, unfortunately, when someone is saying, I can't breathe. And then subsequently, other things kind of follow and it doesn't turn out well. But once he says, I can't breathe, at that point, he lost consciousness. He vomited several times while he was forcibly restrained. And he even apologized for vomiting. He said, I'm sorry, I wasn't trying to do that. I can't breathe correctly. Paramedics arrived at the scene approximately 15 minutes later and administered ketamine, a powerful sedative, to McLean. I didn't realize how common this was, Brittany.
Especially in Colorado.
Yeah. I'm like, what?
Yes.
It doesn't even make sense to me.
Exactly.
So he went into cardiac arrest on the way to the hospital and tragically died a few days later. There is no known video footage from police body cams that document the entirety of the interaction between police, paramedics, and McLean. The statement provided by police that McLean allegedly reached for one of their firearms also cannot be corroborated at this time. Marie Newman, the lawyer representing McLean's family, spoke with media outlets regarding the incident. She said, of course, the fact that all three of their, talking about the Aurora police officers, body cameras fell off is something that we should all be pretty suspicious about. People, what an understatement. It makes, right. I mean, really, it's like, can you understate that anymore? Right. It makes it awfully easy for them to say whatever they want, but what we know is that they attacked him for no reason whatsoever. It was excessive force, and it led to his death. An amended autopsy report indicated that McLean died as a result of complications of ketamine administration after being forcibly restrained. It also reported that McLean would have likely survived the encounter if it were not for the ketamine dosage being higher than the recommended dosage for someone of his size. He weighed 140 pounds, and the dosage that was administered was for someone who weighed 190. Now, how are you supposed to know this as a paramedic? That's one thing that came into my head. I'm like, why are we administering medications?
Weight-based medications
in a situation where you know you're not going to be able to know someone's weight. What are you going to eyeball and tell? No.
That's like giving TPA to a stroke patient without knowing their weight.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whew.
So a group of police officers and paramedics were indicted by a state grand jury on manslaughter, criminally negligent homicide, and other charges in 2021. Police officers Randy Redima, Nathan Woodyard, Jason Rosenblatt, and fire department paramedic Jeremy Cooper, Lieutenant Peter Chichunik, all pleaded not guilty earlier this year. A judge decided to schedule these separate trials, all three of them separately, the first of which is set to begin in July for officers Redima and Rosenblatt. Another trial for Cooper and Kachunik is scheduled for August. Woodyard's trial is set for September. McLean's death fueled renewed scrutiny about the use of ketamine and led to Colorado's health department to issue a rule limiting when emergency workers can use it. McLean was a massage therapist, an animal lover, and a musician. He would often play the violin for stray cats because he believed it soothed them. That broke my heart.
You and me both.
I love my cats so much. Yeah. So I'm such a cat person. I love my dogs too. But to think that, you know, not everyone are cat people. So when I come across someone who not only do they tolerate cats or even like them, but are you really going to go play the violin for stray cats?
Exactly.
I think that's amazing.
Such a big heart.
Yeah. In 2021, the city of Aurora agreed to settle a lawsuit brought by McLean's parents for $15 million.
Our next story, on the night of January 11th, 2018, Colorado, again, police responded to a 911 call about a distressed person trespassing on private property. When police and emergency personnel arrived at a parking lot in Colorado Springs, they found Jerrica LaCour laying on the ground and crying uncontrollably. Police claimed that the intoxicated 29-year-old Black woman was incomprehensible at times, and she was crying about her children and was also completely inconsolable. She was restrained, which I don't know how we got to, you know, from point A to point B. They restrained her, put her on a gurney, put a spit hood on her so that she couldn't spit on the officers. Jason Poulsen, a paramedic for American Medical Response Ambulance Service, administered 400 milligrams of ketamine to LaCour, despite objections from a firefighter who was also an emergency medical technician. Shortly afterward, LaCour stopped breathing. Poulsen did not immediately take LaCour to the hospital, and when the firefighter informed Poulsen that LaCour was not breathing, he responded that she was fine. LaCour died from acute alcohol and ketamine intoxication, the El Paso County Coroner's Office said on its report. It also found that she had recently ingested cocaine and she was an obese person. LaCour's family filed a wrongful death lawsuit against a healthcare worker and the ambulance company, rightfully so. The family's attorney, Daniel Kay, said LaCour was not combative before she was given the ketamine. They stated that LaCour's behavior did not fit the criteria of excited delirium, which is the reason why they were using the ketamine, the lawsuit stated. The lawsuit went on to say that Poulsen owed LaCour a duty of responsible care in providing her emergency care at the scene and was negligent by administering ketamine when other means of restraining LaCour were available and already in use.
Yeah, I told you guys these stories are disturbing. And we're doing this to try to get all these stories out at first before we talk about them to really kind of illustrate. This is literally the tip of the iceberg of these stories. You would not believe the number of these stories that are out there. They're all over. And if you know, if there are this many stories out there, how many of these incidents are going on that are not being reported on, that no one knows anything about, that were just, oh, it was an accident or it was attributed to something else and it was never investigated.
Exactly. So,
on May 26, 2022, the Dallas Police Department responded to a disturbance. Police found 47-year-old LaDamian, better known as Dee Dee Hall, on the scene, visibly frightened and distressed. Police body cam footage shows that police attempted to speak to the Black transgendered woman, but approximately 6 minutes into the conversation, Hall collapsed to the ground and started to speak incoherently. Officers then placed Hall in restraints and held her down while she screamed, and one officer pressed a knee onto her back. Medics placed a spit hood. So this is a mesh bag that is used to prevent someone from spitting or biting police officers over her head and restrained her on a stretcher. While Hall was being transferred to the medic's van, screaming and thrashing about, the body cam footage captured the smiles and laughter of police officers. The footage also captured police misgendering Hall by using incorrect pronouns, even though they knew the situation. Officers began to actively tend to Hall again when they noticed that she was silent and unresponsive. She was then taken to Baylor Hospital, where she was given CPR. Though Hall continued to be unresponsive, Hall was eventually declared dead. The family of the victim stated that they believed her death was preventable, and they demanded a fair investigation. The family stated that the mistreatment that Hall was subjected to was dehumanizing. The family's attorney stated that Hall suffered from bipolar schizophrenia and appeared to be experiencing a mental health episode when officers arrived. The county's autopsy report stated that Hall died from combined toxic effects of cocaine, methamphetamines, and PCP. The report ruled her death as an accident. Hall's family requested an independent autopsy, and the results, per the family's attorney, say they highlighted the negligence of the paramedic and officer involved. The autopsy report indicated that acute heart failure due to strenuous physical activity complicated by how she was restrained contributed to her death. At a news conference in 2022, Hall's family accused first responders of dismissing her repeated cries of distress and dehumanizing her. At multiple points in the body cam footage, Hall can be heard saying, "I'm dying or I'm dead," to the officers. Earlier this month, a Dallas County grand jury declined to indict the police officers and the paramedic. Justin Moore, who represents Hall's family, called the grand jury's decision an affront to justice in a written statement. He said police misgendered Hall and a paramedic callously neglected her.
Yeah, that's a really tough one. I have so much to say about this case, too. So our next case, this one got a lot of media attention. Mm-hmm. So on the night of January 7th, 2023, Tyree Nichols was brutally beaten by five Memphis, Tennessee police officers. Nichols, age 29, had fled a traffic stop before being captured by police. Advanced EMT Jamichael Sandridge and EMT Robert Long arrived at the scene and did not check Nichols' vitals or perform other basic medical examinations for 19 minutes after their arrival. Video footage released by the city of Memphis showed the beating and the aftermath, which included the officers and other first responders chatting and milling about as Nichols was left unattended. He displayed, quote, clear signs of distress, such as inability to remain in a seated posture and lying prone on the ground multiple times, end quote. Nichols died 3 days later at the hospital, and the officers were terminated from their positions. They have been charged with second-degree murder and have pleaded not guilty. The paramedics were also fired from their positions. The Tennessee Emergency Medical Services Divisions suspended the licenses of Sandridge and Long. Officials said they violated state rules of emergency aid and treatment.
Yeah, and this next story I've mentioned before on the podcast. It's one that it's so disturbing. It's hard to imagine. It's really hard to imagine a healthcare professional treating a human being like this. So around 2 a.m. on December 18th in 2022 in Springfield, Illinois, police arrived at an apartment complex. They had received a 911 call proclaiming that some people had accessed an apartment with firearms. Upon arriving at the apartment complex, authorities encountered 35-year-old Earl J. Moore Jr., who was experiencing alcohol withdrawal-induced hallucinations. He had been the one to contact police. He had called police. A woman let officers into the home where she told police that there was no one there with guns. She explained that they were called for no reason and that Moore was suffering from alcohol withdrawals. He hadn't had a drink in days, she said. She advised officers that Moore was seeing things that weren't there and hearing voices. She had taken him to the hospital before and felt discouraged that all the hospital did was release him each time. An ambulance was called and arrived minutes later. LifeStar Ambulance Service paramedic Peggy Finley, she was 44, and Peter Cadigan, who was 50, responded to the residents. Shortly after entering the apartment, Finley began to yell at the disoriented Moore. Per police body cam footage, Finley told Moore that she wasn't going to play with him and ordered him to, quote, quit acting stupid. She said that they weren't going to carry him to the ambulance and that she, quote, wasn't in the mood to deal with him. It was police who assisted Moore outside to a stretcher. Police video footage showed paramedics loading Moore onto the stretcher and into the ambulance. The footage ends soon afterwards. Finley and Cadigan transported Moore to St. John's a few minutes after Moore was strapped face down into a stretcher. He was reported as being unresponsive and not breathing. Despite efforts to resuscitate him, he was pronounced dead at the hospital about an hour later. Finley reportedly called the Springfield police officer from the scene. That's one of the, Finley is one of the paramedics, and attempted to coax him into telling hospital officials that Moore was responsive at his home and was, quote, a different patient between the time he was picked up by the ambulance to when he arrived at the hospital. After Moore's death, Finley also falsely claimed to state police that she had taken Moore's vitals during transport from the scene. However, hospital staff said no vitals were produced by either Finley or Cadigan. On a recorded call, Finley would later advise hospital officials that Moore was, quote, slightly combative and confused when they responded to the residents. The state attorney, however, disagreed with Finley's statement. He pointed out that police body cam footage depicted a man in a weakened and confused state of mental distress, unable to walk, and in desperate need of specialized medical care. A forensic pathologist ruled that Moore died of compressional and positional asphyxia due to being placed face down on a stretcher and transported to the hospital with straps tightened across his back. And when I say tightened, they were tightened as tight as they could. Watch the video. They tightened them as tight as they could. And apparently this is just something that they do, that it's just almost like a punishment type of thing, of like, it will show you, you know, what kind of, how this is not going to be a fun trip for you if you're going to act this way, basically. So a patient restraint policy set by Memorial Health, the organization that oversees medical care provided by LifeStar, says patients should never be transported in the prone position or face down. That seems to me like the biggest no-brainer in the history of no-brainers. Moore's death was investigated by the Illinois State Police. First-degree murder charges were brought against Cadigan and Finley. The pair face up to 60 years in prison if convicted. The case is pending trial, but no court date has been publicly announced. This was very recent that this happened.
It was.
Yeah. Those are the stories. As we said, there are a lot more, unfortunately, than just this. But Brittany specifically reached out about the Earl Moore Jr. case because there's so many things about it that are wrong.
A few of the things that stood out to me, particularly with Elijah McClain's story, is one, you know, the 911 call apparently reported that he was being sketchy, right? Walking with his, you know, waving his arms. But when you see the body cam footage, he's just walking, right? He's just a normal person walking with a grocery bag in his hand and doing absolutely nothing threatening or suspicious. And being a Black man with a ski mask on is not suspicious. And if you live in Chicago, that's actually probably one of the most common things that you see, especially like in the fall and winter months, is everyone wears a ski mask because it's very cold. And especially with Elijah being anemic. But, you know, one of the things that stood out to me was, one, he was just walking like a normal person. Two, at one point during the scuffle, you know, of him being restrained by police officers, Elijah said, I'm just different. That's all. And it just made me so sad because he's trying to explain to these folks, you know, I'm not doing anything bad. I'm just trying to go home. I just want to go home. And, you know, it just seemed to enrage officers more, you know, because they don't see him as explaining himself. They see him as being talking back. Right. And it just broke my heart. But a couple of good things that came from Elijah's case is there were bills passed. House Bill 1251 was passed. It's titled Appropriate Use of Chemical Restraints on a Person. And basically, it really tightens up the guidelines for who can use ketamine, when they can use ketamine, and for what reason. And so I'm glad that his situation sort of sparked this change, because it seems like, so I think it was June 2021 to June 2022, there were 1,500 cases where medics were giving ketamine because folks were, quote unquote, acting up. And so it seems like it's such a common thing for Colorado paramedics, and there needed to be some control, you know, from a leadership and governmental aspect to limit the use of ketamine, because obviously it's harming people.
Yes, absolutely. I was shocked to see that this was something that they administer in these situations. I've never given in the hospital. I've never given ketamine or anywhere. I've worked in a psych facility before. I've never heard of ketamine being given for this reason, but I know it's a different state, so state to state, you're going to have different laws. But wow.
Yeah.
I don't know. Another thing that kind of strikes me about these stories is, so there's sometimes in healthcare, it's different. When you're in the healthcare profession, you see a lot of things. There's a lot of just trauma that you can witness, and negative things you can witness, sad things you can witness, all sorts of things. And we sometimes cope with that by laughing, mm-hmm. making kind of like almost making light of the situation. It's like a way to keep yourself from going in too dark of a place, I guess, and trying to, if you get too depressed and down about every single situation that you see, you're not going to be able to do your job. And so right. It's almost like a coping mechanism, right? We call it gallows humor or whatever, dark humor.
Yes.
The thing is, though, there's a time and place for that. And it's not when an actual situation is going on. That is not the time to be, you know, in some of these stories, like milling around, smiling and laughing. No, that is not appropriate when
exactly
this is going on. And another thing is when someone says, I can't breathe, I have been in situations before working at the hospital where a patient has said, I can't breathe. And I've heard people say, you can breathe. If you're talking, you can breathe. Have you ever heard someone say that?
Yes, mm-hmm. So often.
Yeah.
I hear it so often.
Is it true?
It's so false.
It's not true. You can talk. You can talk and still
not be able to breathe.
Because breathing is not just, for one thing, talking is you're using air is going out. Okay. Right. Air is going out. And yes, you can still take in enough air to be able to get words out and express yourself while still suffocating, you know? So don't, just because someone is talking to you, please do not take that as a sign that they are not in respiratory distress or in some sort of distress.
Exactly.
Trust me, if somebody says, I can't breathe, please take it seriously every single time.
Yes.
And I do believe this is an education issue in some cases. I think that a lot of people hear that. If you're a new grad, you start working on the floor at a hospital, and you hear that maybe the respiratory therapist or a seasoned nurse say something like that. Don't tell me you can't breathe. You know, if you're talking to me, you can breathe. So now you as a new grad have just learned that, mm-hmm. and take it as, oh, yeah, that's true. That makes sense. If you're talking, you're breathing, right? Air must be going out and in.
If this person with experience is saying it must be true.
Right.
Right.
This is why we do these podcasts, to talk about this stuff so that we can help bring to light some things that are said and done in healthcare that are just wrong, just flat out wrong, not true. These are not things that you should be saying, not the way you should be acting, not the way you should be treating patients.
Exactly.
So in this next story that we talked about, also in Colorado.
This one also just frustrated me so much. If someone is intoxicated, you know, if you're a medic, if you're a paramedic and you're licensed to give a medication like ketamine, then you should know that ketamine plus alcohol equals increased sedation, i.e. increased respiratory depression risk. Right. So if you all are responding to someone who is, as you say, inconsolable, and you smell alcohol on their breath, what makes you think that it's appropriate to give a big old fat dose of ketamine, especially when someone was already calming down once they got onto the gurney?
We all know that when we're taking any medication or supplement, dosage matters, and it's important to take enough to get the desired result. For example, only taking a 10 milligram Tylenol might not help with your headache. Well, the same is true for CBD. If you try a low-dose CBD product, you may not feel anything. But it's not the CBD's fault. The dosage is the problem. This is why CBD Stat only makes high-dose CBD products that actually work. And now, their products are getting even stronger. CBD Stat is happy to announce that they're launching a new extra-strength version of its highly popular topical products that have 7,500 milligrams of CBD. This new strength will by far maintain CBD Stat's status as the most powerful CBD product line on the market. More CBD means it's more effective in helping everyone tackle daily aches and pains. CBD Stat sent me a box of these new products, and I already knew it was going to work because I've been using it for my neck pain and foot pain, but I can definitely tell a difference in this new strength, and I'm really excited to get to tell you guys about it. And on top of these new higher strength products, they're also dropping prices across the board on all their products to make CBD Stat not only the most effective on the market, but also the most affordable. And don't forget, all you healthcare workers out there, get a special additional discount to help keep you strong. Just head to cbdstat.care/healthcare and find your new secret weapon. That's cbdstat.care/healthcare. One thing that stands out to me about this story and a couple of these other stories is the mental health aspect of the stories. And this is something that several years ago, I was talking with a nurse who worked for years at a psychiatric facility, and she worked at a teen, like the adolescent side, pediatric, I guess. And she told me that one time there was a teenager who kind of having a mental health episode, as we said earlier, sort of a crisis. And so their policy at this facility was to call the police because the staff feels unsafe. So they have done everything that they can physically to restrain. And so this teenager, and so in order to safely be able to maybe administer medicine to them to help get them under control, they had to call the police. And she said that after this incident, she never personally called the police again because she said they are absolutely not equipped and educated with how to handle a person in a mental health crisis. And they came and basically just treated this child like they were just a criminal, as opposed to being someone in a mental health crisis. This is the problem with this situation.
Yes, absolutely. And I see it often. You know, I've worked across state lines, and, you know, I don't know how much training security guards go through, you know, who work in the hospital, as far as that, the mental health aspect of care and trauma-informed care. But I once had, it wasn't even my patient, but someone was becoming louder and louder, right? And they were there for a mental health complaint. And there was a security alert called. So myself and a couple other nurses went to go help out. And I was able to start de-escalating this person. And right when I got her to sit down, which was a huge accomplishment, right? Like, she sat down, which means we're getting there. Security guards rushed in and told me, get out, we're restraining this patient. And I'm thinking to myself, and I said out loud, for what? We're sitting down, we're de-escalating, we're calming down. And it's just a total lack of regard. All they were thinking was, no, our job is to restrain them. We're here to restrain them. It doesn't matter where you're at in the de-escalation process. And so I think that we really have to prioritize trauma-informed care education to outside of like primary, the person primarily caring for the patient. So the security officers and everyone else that's involved, crisis workers, you know, folks just get so amped up and they're so ready to just punish a patient who is experiencing something that's terrifying to them. And instead of being patient, everyone wants to just restrain someone and move on, right? And we really have to learn to take the time to listen to folks, to try to use our verbal de-escalation skills instead of rushing to the restraints.
Yes, and I'll tell you something else. When someone is having any sort of mental health crisis or episode, whether, you know, you could have someone that has dementia, someone who has alcohol in alcohol withdrawals, going through hallucinations, someone who's just has some sort of mental health process, you know, that they're dealing, right, like schizophrenia or something like that, or just a drug induced, whether it's something that they were given. Sometimes we give patients medicines at the hospital, like for sedate, like go into surgery. I've had this happen before. A patient goes into surgery, they get general anesthesia, they are literally out of it. They extubate them, bring them back in, and they're not the same person. They are completely, they don't know where they are. And it can last a long time, and it's scary to the family because they're like, is he ever going to be okay?
Right.
Well, no matter what the reason is for a person that is confused, saying weird things, or just even upset, there is no reason for you to raise your voice to them and get argumentative. That is not going to help anyone involved. It's
exactly.
just not.
It's so inappropriate.
Only, it's only going to make it worse. But how many times have you seen somebody, have you ever seen another healthcare professional at the hospital who's literally arguing with the person with dementia?
Yes.
Like, this person has dementia. They will argue with you all day long. Why?
Exactly. That says so much more about the healthcare professional than the patient. What are you doing?
Right. It's like, they called me a this or that. I'm like, they have no idea who you are or what you are, and they don't care
exactly.
if they called you the B word or whatever. They would call anyone that. They might call you a cat. They might, but you have to be professional enough and mature enough to recognize it for what it is and not engage, because that will escalate the problem as opposed to de-escalating.
Exactly. And I bring this up all the time on social media, is that if you've willingly choose to escalate someone as a medical professional, you don't belong at the bedside. If that's who you are, and if you think that's okay, if you think that's appropriate, all you're doing is putting that person in danger, right? Because you escalate them, they get to a point where now we have to talk about more sort of restrictive measures to calm this person down, when all you had to do from the beginning is, you know, use your de-escalation techniques instead of trying to literally argue with someone. It just doesn't make any sense.
Exactly. And, you know, when it comes to the story of Earl Moore Jr., I can't, it's one thing to be talking about situations where maybe an EMT or paramedic was, maybe they administered too much ketamine, or they didn't assess them soon enough, or
right.
I mean, all that stuff is terrible, and they obviously need education, and in some cases should not even have their license or whatever. But this particular case, it goes so far above anything that should be considered healthcare. It's to me what I could see on the body cam footage that I watched myself. Just like I said, talking to somebody who's clearly having hallucinations, those workers did not understand what alcohol withdrawal is and what the symptoms that it causes and the situation that man was in. He was obviously vulnerable. So to treat him that way with such disregard for his life, it's inexplicable.
It really is. It really is. It's disgusting. It really speaks to the mindset of the paramedics that were caring for him, because they weren't caring for him. The ones that were responsible for caring for him. I give credit where credit's due. When I watched the footage over and over again, and while Earl was struggling to get out of the house to the ambulance, the only people to help him get back up when he fell were the police officers. Meanwhile, Peggy Finley just stood there in disgust, right? She had no intention of helping him at all at any point. And I read somewhere that later on they found out that Peggy said that the reason why she didn't check his vital signs is because she didn't want to poke the bear. And I hear that often, where people will be like, I'm not going to check vitals because I don't want to get them all riled up. What makes more sense, checking their vitals and with the potential of them getting riled up, or not checking their vitals and they're dead?
Yeah. Well, I just think that people in that situation, I don't believe that she thought this patient was going to die. I do not believe that. I do believe that she understood the discomfort that she was allowing him to be in, and the distress, the increased distress that she was causing, and had a complete disregard for anything to do with comfort or trying to help him to feel better.
Right.
So, and I think that the doing the vital signs just to her wasn't necessary, because he's just coming down, you know, off the alcohol, and You know, I get so tired of doing these stories about patients who die in jails from alcohol withdrawal. But I will keep doing them, and I will keep talking about it and trying to explain it to people, because not only nurses who work at the bedside and deal with this, they get it. I mean, we see it. We see what happens.
Yeah.
But I think that just if you're anywhere removed from that situation, I don't think people get it. And even people who drink, obviously, Mr. Moore did not understand. Some people can do it and get away with it, but oftentimes you cannot just stop drinking cold turkey if you drink a lot of alcohol every day, you know, on a regular basis and have been doing that for a long time. You can't just stop. Your body will go through all kinds of just changes, and your brain will play tricks on you. It's like you become a completely different person. You have no control over yourself. And she clearly didn't understand that about.
Yeah. And it seems like Earl and his family had some sort of understanding, because they had been to the hospital, right? And they just weren't getting any answers or any recommendations. Well, I'm assuming, right? Because we don't know what happened. We just know that they kept getting discharged. We know that they went at least twice. So it makes me wonder, was there education? You know, at any point, did they think maybe we should admit him to see him through this withdrawal? I work in the ER. We've admitted hundreds of patients to monitor them through their withdrawal and just to make sure that they aren't having seizures and things like that. And so it just makes me wonder, what did that look like? What did those visits to the hospital look like that landed Earl back at home in a hallucinatory state?
Yeah. And I just wonder, you know, were they maybe giving him medication, you know, lithium or something at the hospital that was helping with the symptoms, but then when he gets discharged, he doesn't have that stuff to help him with the symptoms? Or did he start drinking again and then it go right back and the cycle? The main problem, let me be perfectly clear. The main problem in this story is the fact that the paramedics in this story had a complete lack of regard for Mr. Moore's life. Completely, they were so callous and had no empathy and had no business being in the position that they were in. Okay, that's number one. But also, in our country, we do not take care of people with mental health issues, which is really almost everyone. Mm-hmm. It is just not a priority. It's just not. And when you talk about alcohol addiction and drug addiction, I think a lot of people think, well, if you choose to take those things, no. Oh. No. I mean, we could be here all day if we go back and explain why that is just not true.
Right.
But let me just say, if you're one of those people who just think, well, it's not my problem because I'm not addicted to anything, and I don't think we should be spending money on that if they choose. It costs our society and our communities way more, the repercussions of people being addicted to these things. But also, you stop and think about a child, an 8-year-old, I've done these stories, an 8-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old, who's given drugs because their parents are on drugs, or they find them, or they see them being these. Sometimes people start at such a young age, they literally did not have a choice. Right. They really didn't. They don't know anything else. So not to get off on a huge Tina tangent on that, but it's so easy.
I love Tina tangents.
It's so easy for me to do. Just to say that we do not take mental health care seriously enough in this, and certainly not in the state that I live in, but I don't think we take it seriously enough in this country.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And it reaches a whole different level when the person is a person of color, or they're a queer person, or in Didi's case, a trans person. And it's heartbreaking, right? You know, thinking about Didi's story and how she was misgendered in the last moments of her life. And this is another one where I watched the footage a few times to sort of get, not to be, you know, weird or like the whole like trauma thing, but just watching the behavior of the medics and the police officers specifically. And when Didi was in the ambulance and sort of on that downward, you know, slope of agitation, but it transitioned from agitation to somnolence to unresponsiveness, right? Didi, the paramedic that was behind her was literally like on his phone. And I'm just thinking to myself, maybe instead of a spit hood, some oxygen, you know, what could have been done? You know, I understand that final cause of death was ruled as accidental because of drugs. But, you know, what could have been done to better care for her and potentially prevent the cardiac arrest that occurred? And, you know, we don't know how long she was in cardiac arrest before they actually started compressions. And what really frustrated me is, first of all, one-handed compressions frustrate me in general. That's a thing that I just don't like to see. It makes me upset. They're not effective. And that's what the medic was doing for Dee Dee, is one-handed compressions. And then, you know, us as medical providers know that compression should never be interrupted for more than 10 seconds. And I counted many more than 10 seconds that the paramedic stopped doing compressions while they were getting Dee Dee out of the ambulance. And so just a total lack of care. And they really just dropped the ball at so many stops, especially with, it started with the way that they approached her and then responded to her upset and then misgendered her. And that just broke my heart.
Yeah. And the misgendering could definitely be a triggering thing that could cause escalation of her mental health, you know, issues if she's, depending on what state she's in.
Yeah.
And yes, the accurate ACLS protocol is so important. And you would really think that a paramedic who must deal with this on the regular should know exactly what to do in a situation. I mean, right. I've seen people in the hospital who, where I'm just thinking, it's been a couple of years for your ACLS, I guess. It's okay. I guess we
right.
need to, you know.
My
but,
goodness.
Because sometimes people are just like, you're just like, whoa, that's not how I saw it. But the thing is, the reason we say you have to do those good quality compressions is that you are literally pumping blood through that, to that person's brain. If you're not getting blood to their brain, they're going to get an anoxic brain injury. You have to do that consistently. You can't stop until, you know, you get a pulse. But unfortunately, there's so many opportunities for education in healthcare, myself included. I learn things
Same.
All the time. Yeah. I mean,
every day,
all the time. You're just like, oh my gosh, I've always done it this way. I didn't realize that wasn't the way we're supposed to do it. And so I'm one of the people who advocate for education and redirection and disciplinary action, as opposed to just like, especially not criminal charges in most cases when a healthcare professional makes a mistake or just, you know, doing something that sometimes we think they should have known better. And in a lot of cases, maybe there's something that you're doing that somebody else would think you should have known better. And so just try not to judge people so much. But the thing is, if you stop and think about just a person off the street who has nothing to do with healthcare, if that person could step into a situation and know what to do better than the way you handled it,
yeah,
that's a clue.
Yeah, that's a problem. Exactly. And honestly, education is huge with all of these cases. But another piece that's incredibly important and cannot be overstated is examining our biases, right? Because they affect the way that we approach situations. When EMS got the call that a man was having hallucinations, when they got the call for Earl Moore Jr., they already had in their head an idea of who he was. They already decided who he was, what they thought of him, and they knew how they were going to approach the situation, right? And they came in, you know, with the attitude of like, I'm in charge, I don't have time for this, get up, you know, mm-hmm. a very disciplinary sort of attitude. And we really have to take a step back and think, how do I feel about this type of person? How do I feel about that type of person? One of the stories that I told in my book was a story of a very just massive, I mean, probably like close to 7 feet, black man that came into the ER ripping his shirt off, like the Hulk, like just ripping his shirt off saying, I can't breathe, right? And he's saying, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. And there's that statement again, I can't mm-hmm. breathe, there's something going on. And the nurse that happened to be in triage was like, you need to calm down, you know, stop doing that, put a mask on, you know, and just like very, you know, you're being dramatic. And fast forward, that patient ended up being rushed to the back by myself and the charge nurse, and he was in SVT. Yes, yes, at a rate of like 240 or something. I mean, it was outrageous. And so, you know, later on having a discussion with that nurse of like, you know, if this was somebody else who looked different, right? What road would we have taken? We had to have the uncomfortable conversations that people need to think about how they feel about certain populations of people, homeless people, poor people, Black people, trans people, gay people,
prisoners, you
know, prisoners. Oh my God, that's a really good one. Prisoners. How do we feel about these populations? You know, I have to take care of people that have swastikas tattooed on their faces, right? I cannot walk into their room to take care of them without acknowledging how I feel about that whole situation, right? And just making sure that I don't let it impact the way that I care for them. Because regardless, they still deserve my best self as a nurse. It doesn't matter what their history is. It doesn't matter what they think or how they feel. I owe them my best self because that's what I signed up for when I decided I wanted to be a nurse.
Well put. Very, very, very well put. Thank you, Brittany.
Thank you.
So I have to tell you guys about an experience I had with a nursing student. So, you know, I've been doing travel nursing. Well, this hospital where I'm at has a lot of LPN students doing their clinicals there. So one of them was following me around one day and she noticed my stethoscope. And of course, y'all know the Echo technology company that sponsors our podcast. They teamed up with Littmann to make the stethoscopes, to beat all stethoscopes, the 3M Littmann Core Digital Stethoscope. And this is the one that I use now. So she said, oh my gosh, I've been wanting to try one of those. So of course I let her use it and she just could not stop talking about it for the rest of the shift. It was so cute. She was like, you know, I can't hear anything with my normal stethoscope because I have tinnitus. And so she was so excited because she could actually hear what heart sounds were supposed to sound like. She said, I'm going to ask for one of these for graduation. And I was like, yeah, you definitely should. So just so you know, the Echo technology that makes the stethoscope so amazing, you can enable it with a flip of a switch. You can turn it on and off. It has active noise cancellation up to 40 times amplification, wireless auscultation using Bluetooth technology. It connects with Echo's free app and software so that you can visualize, record, share, live stream, analyze heart sounds, lung sounds, and whatever body sounds you want to listen to. So you can go to echohealth.com and use the promo code GNBN to get $50 off your order. And that's Echo is spelled E-K-O, by the way. So it's echohealth.com and use the GNBN promo code to get $50 off your order. I also wanted to remind you that if you're interested in travel nursing, to go to trustedhealth.com/goodnurse and fill out a profile so you can see what kind of jobs are out there. And you can also see what they pay, the stipend, the hourly rate, all of that. I'm a travel nurse now with Trusted Health, and I absolutely love working for them. So go to trustedhealth.com, be sure and put /goodnurse so that they'll know that we sent you there, and fill out a profile today.
Sometimes I try to, if possible, kind of balance out the good portion with it's almost like the opposite of the bad nurse story. So since we were kind of picking on EMTs and paramedics, which by the way, I love and I'm absolutely amazed by the job that they do, for one thing, and the courage that they have to go into the situations that they have to go into. So I appreciate them for what they do, appreciate the sacrifice and the risk that they take for their jobs. So this story is just amazing. I think it's really cool. It's from NPR.org. And the article is called How a Team of Black Paramedics Set the Gold Standard for Emergency Medical Response. This is neat. There's a really cool picture of like back in the day in 1975, like this ambulance. It looks like a van. I mean, I don't know. It looks, but there's like all this equipment in there. It says Freedom House Ambulance. And there is a woman in there who is a doctor, Dr. Nancy Caroline, with paramedic Walt Brown. This article says it's difficult to imagine society without assurance that skilled professional paramedics will respond to a medical emergency. And of course, as I said, we are very appreciative of those people. Before the 1970s, clumsy, haphazard care, often at the hands of police officers. It's so funny how this goes, you know, like literally with the story that we were just doing, was the norm for emergencies. So much so that negligent ambulance care was responsible for an estimated 1,200 to 2,000 preventable deaths per year in the United States. according to journalist and former paramedic Kevin Hazard. So, in his new book, American Sirens, Hazard narrates the 8-year saga of the Freedom House Ambulance Service, the all-Black team of paramedics who pioneered the profession from 1968 to 1975 in Pittsburgh. The book documents an untold piece of American history, recording how Freedom House saved thousands of lives and influenced the emergence of professional paramedic services in cities across the U.S., eventually setting the gold standard of emergency medical care. How cool is that?
It's amazing. I mean, it's also sort of like unbelievable to think about the fact that before EMS, police were responding to all of these calls.
Yeah. I mean, right.
Who else? Right.
Yeah. And then no medical training. Maybe they had some, but
yeah,
they're showing up to people being shot, to people having limbs cut off, people being stabbed. Auto accidents.
And they're like, let's just get him to the hospital.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Pretty much no medical training. I mean, that you can see why there would be that many people who would die every year if you don't have healthcare professionals who are on the scene, first responders.
Exactly.
So this Kevin Hazard, he begins the book through the eyes of John Moon, a Black man who was born into poverty in Atlanta's Grady Hospital, but found his calling as a Freedom House recruit. Other prominent Freedom House contributors include Dr. Peter Safar, the Austrian-born physician who co-founded Freedom House Ambulance Service shortly after he invented mouth-to-mouth resuscitation.
Yes.
And isn't that cool?
Yes.
And Dr. Nancy Caroline, the first medical director of Freedom House, who authored the seminal emergency medical services text, Emergency Care in the Streets. So Hazard, in his book, feels like a paramedic ride along, he said, witnessing medical chaos, intubating patients against the clock, confronting frightened patients and their distressed relatives, and competing with an adversarial police force. I can't imagine. I'm afraid of the emergency room because of the chaos and all the disorder that, you know, it's just everything is so, you don't know what in the world is walking through the door. There's emotions run high.
Yes.
It's like by the time they get back to the floor, everything's at least calmed down. The ER staff has kind of filtered out the riffraff, so to speak, you know? So it's a little bit, you know, we still have to obviously deal with drama, but can you imagine even beyond the emergency room, you're talking about out in the community?
Yeah. I was an EMT basic for the first 2 years of my career. And I tell you what, that was something, you know, because you're literally walking into houses that you don't know what's behind the door. Right. And one of my first calls was a wellness check because they hadn't heard from grandma. And can you guess what happened to grandma? Mm-hmm. Grandma passed away a few days prior, you know, and that was, I mean, just heartbreaking, terrifying. I couldn't do it. So here I am in the hospital.
Yeah. You're like, I'm yeah. Get one step ahead of this. Yeah. Exactly. Let somebody else. Mm-hmm. I don't blame you.
Hats off to them.
Yes. So most shocking are the stories of preventable deaths before the advent of EMS, illustrating the crater-wide gap the Freedom House service filled. Wealthy white Pittsburgh residents could afford private ambulances, while residents of the Hill District, the city's oldest Black neighborhood, barely received basic city services, let alone a chance for survival in a medical emergency. Freedom House provided much-needed medical care in a neglected community. It also provided employment and training opportunities for dignified work. Some members of the team were high school dropouts. None had formal medical training whatsoever. They became skilled paramedics and dispatchers, saving lives. And you know, I found out I had a paramedic on several weeks ago, and I knew this because I actually worked with her on the floor, but she was a paramedic before she went to nursing school. Mm-hmm. And so when we started working with her, I was completely shocked to find out that paramedics really can do anything an RN can do.
Oh, yeah.
They go to school for like a year, depending on, you know, I guess what state you're in. But they have to cram all that knowledge, you know, into a year. And they have to be able to do all these things because it's an emergency.
It's an emergency. Exactly.
So I was pretty shocked to find out, you know, the extent of the things that they're able to do. And I'm glad that they are. They can hang blood. They can hang heparin. They can do all kinds of stuff.
Intubate. I mean, it's amazing.
Mm-hmm. You know, but at the same time, they are taking on a huge responsibility. And I feel like we have to balance that because you want people to be willing to take on the responsibility, you know, so you don't want to necessarily go handcuffing and criminalizing every person that makes a mistake in that situation.
Yes.
But we have to balance that with the fact that if you do decide to take on that responsibility, you are going to have to be held to a higher standard.
Yep, exactly.
You know, because you are taking on that responsibility of caring for people. You got to check your biases at the door. You got to take care of everyone equally.
Yeah. I mean, and honestly, like, I think it's important for all medical professionals to understand the difference between equality and equity, right? So just as we're talking about Freedom House paramedics and how certain neighborhoods, they could afford, you know, private ambulances, they could arrive at their door like that. And then poor neighborhoods, they couldn't afford, you know, they weren't given the resources, right? So we have to imagine equity as, you know, a level playing ground. So a level playing field for everybody. So if someone who lives in a poor neighborhood, they might need different resources than a person who lives on the Upper East Side of New York, right, in a fancy condo. And so it's really important to understand that and for all of us to realize that everyone needs to be treated equally to an extent, but then there's equity that needs to be considered as well.
Well, just to remind you guys, the name of his book, it's Kevin Hazard. His book is American Sirens, and I guess you should check that out. Also, Brittany, you happen to be an author too. What's the name of your book?
Yes, it's titled Journal of a Black Queer Nurse. I'm so happy that it's finally released and out in the world, and people are reaching out, and we're having conversations, you know, which was the goal. The goal was for us to have these really difficult conversations and to sort of start looking at the way that, you know, our behavior impacts people's lives every single day, not just in healthcare either.
Yes, not just in healthcare. I say that so many times because so many of the things, you know, my son was working at a restaurant for a while, and he would come home and talk about, he was working as a server, and he would come home talking about his experience working with the public and dealing with serving people and their orders and their complaints and having, you know, his station of like four tables and I'm like, the comparisons between working as a server in a restaurant are, I don't mean to offend anybody. Obviously I'm a nurse. I'm just saying, stop and think about it. The comparisons are, it's
insane.
It is insane because, you know, think about it. You have your station of
patients,
quote, patients.
Pods, yeah.
A nurse has their team of patients and a server has their, you know, station of their tables. And you have a hostess who is bringing customers to seat, and they seat you, they double seat you. They come and bring you two customers at the same time.
Yep.
And so then what, you're overwhelmed. So now you've got people mad because you can't be in two places at once. Same thing goes in the hospital. And so, and I used to tell Levi all the time because he would be telling me these things. And I'm like, hey, imagine somebody's hooked up to, you know, they've got an IV in their arm and they're hooked up to all these drips and their blood pressure's tanking. And, you know, you've got these situations where people's lives are literally in the balance. So you add all that into, and that's pretty much what it's like to be a nurse.
Exactly. It's so similar. The other day I had, right at shift change, right when I was about to leave, EMS rolls in with a new patient for me, and his blood pressure was like in the 70s. So, it's all hands on deck.
So you're like, okay, bye, I got to go.
Right.
No.
I'm getting all my supplies ready, and I'm like, all right, two IVs, let's get some blood drawn, let's hang some fluids. And literally one of my patients down the hall is standing in the doorway of his room as I'm rifling through the IV drawer to get supplies, and he's like, I asked you for a sandwich.
This is like this is almost like becoming a cliche. This is how often this happens.
I'm telling you.
There needs to be a sign or something in patients' rooms that literally says, if your nurse has not been in here or someone has not been able, you know, to attend to you, please understand that there could be life-saving measures that are happening in the next room beside you.
Exactly.
So please be patient. I feel like that doesn't happen enough. And I get so frustrated because we're supposed to treat patients like they're customers, as, you know, here I was comparing the two. But really, they're not customers, and it's not a restaurant, and it's not a hotel. And it, while you want to treat people with dignity and you want to try, I don't want you to be hungry. I want you to have your sandwich.
Of course. But read the room, yes. Right? Read the room. Right. If I was sitting here on my phone, which I wouldn't be, but that would be understandable. But you see me like desperately trying to gather supplies to go help someone whose life is in danger. Yeah. And, you know, read the room.
Man, if I had all the signs up in the patient's rooms that I wanted to educate them about, the whole place would be wallpapered. I'd be like, start reading over there and yes, don't stop.
Don't stop till you reach the end. Like, I love you. I care about you. I'm not neglecting you. I promise I'll be back. But I have you times four, right? And everyone needs something. And I have to pee at some point.
At some point. I'm doing my best. Yeah. I mean, I might go 12 hours without doing it, but at some point, yeah.
Exactly.
But we will neglect ourselves so many times in order to get that person their sandwich. You know, we'll take them their sandwich before we'll go sit down.
Oh, you know. 100%. 100%. But again, you know, it's what we signed up for.
It is. It absolutely is. Yep. Well, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast, Brittany.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for having me. Truly. I also, there's a podcast called Distrust and Disparities. It's, they have a really good episode on the Freedom House paramedics too, that they released here. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. It's really cool. They released it in February of this year.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. The host is a nurse and the co-host is, she does more work in like public health education, advocacy work. It's pretty sweet.
That's interesting. I'll have to reach out to them. Maybe they will.
Yeah, definitely. Collaborate. Oh, yes. Absolutely.
That'd be awesome. Well, guys, thank you so much for listening to another episode. And of course, you can find me, you can email me if you want to at tina@goodnursebadnurse.com. You can find me at my website at goodnursebadnurse.com. And I'm on social media. I guess what? Good Nurse, Bad Nurse. It's pretty much it's what it's been for 5 years now. Oh my goodness. We literally at our 1 year anniversary, or a 5 year anniversary. It's so, doesn't even, it's not even real.
We're lucky to have y'all.
Well, we feel lucky to have you too, Brittany. Thank you so much for being here. Hopefully we get to see a lot more of you in the future.
Definitely.
And of course we have to remind you, even if you're a bad girl or a bad boy, be a good nurse.